welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Welcome, if this is your first time, and welcome back if you've been here before. This is now episode 85, so we really are getting there now. As I think I talked about last week, almost finished the series. Career is almost over in the podcast world. Thanks very much for the downloads this week. Very good. Really good, in fact. Again, thank you. And thanks for those that bought me a coffee as well. I had a few coffees this week, so I appreciate that. So we're going to... one thing I just wanted to touch on as well is the picture that I used for the podcast that you can see on YouTube. And if you get it off of RSS, you can see the picture that I put on for the episode. It was a green sort of cartoon frog, and... some of you may be aware, and probably most of you not, but it wasn't a random frog. That is actually called Pepe the Frog. And Pepe was originally devised, I think, as a cartoon character. And I don't know why, to be honest with you, but it got picked up for some reason by right-wing types and then various others. And it actually became sort of very well used on all sorts of really unpleasant websites, but they adapted it. So it took on all different guises. So, for example, there is a Nazi version of Pepe the Frog that has, you know, swastikas and an SS uniform. There's an incel version of Pepe the Frog. There is a Ku Klux Klan version, would you believe, who is all in white, you know, with a white hood. And very much Pepe has been picked up by these sort of right-wing Nazi incel types and used... in various guises, which is why I put him on, just to go along with the sort of incel story that I told. Had quite a bit of interest on that on YouTube, interestingly, and I wonder whether the photo actually attracted, you know, the wrong sort of people, if you know what I mean. But anyway, there we go. I hope you enjoyed that last one. So this week it's going to be something different, and perhaps something that you wouldn't expect me to have dealt with given my role. So if you remember, at this point in my career I was a counter-terrorist liaison officer, and I've already explained a couple of episodes ago sort of what that role entailed. But it still entailed kind of looking after various aspects of the CT world for my particular sort of policing division. And one of those things that I covered, I'm pretty sure I said, was MPs, members of parliament, looking after their security, both their personal security and their offices, at their home addresses, etc. Because those sorts of people, as we know, you know, can attract definitely a lot of controversy depending on, you know, their thoughts and views and what bills they vote for, etc. And that can change. That's quite flexible. So at the time, I was dealing with an inquiry in relation to one of the MPs I looked after, and he'd been harassed, pretty much stalked online. It started off fairly minor, but it sort of progressed into hundreds and then literally thousands of emails almost daily from this one individual to him. And it went from, you know, freedom of speech, because people say, oh, I've got a right to contact my MP. Well, of course you have, you know, but when you're doing it, you know, 250 times a day, then obviously it starts to get a bit much. And it got to the point where it was just getting ridiculous. And it was edging into, you know, what would become a criminal offence if you look at the offence of harassment down in England, and certainly stalking in Scotland. They're similar sorts of offences, just different sort of terminology, but effectively they're a course of conduct. If you, you know, stalking or harassment can be pretty much anything, and we normally think of it in a domestic context, so quite often it's the scenario, and again, this one surprises some people, repeated flower sending to a partner that you've split up from that has made it very clear, you know, that's the end of our relationship, I don't want any more contact from you, yet they get absolutely bombarded by gifts, you know, cash, flowers, you know, potentially quite nice things if they were wanted, but of course they're unwanted. And when that has been made very clear to that person, they continue, and then again it gets to very silly levels. That's kind of quite often what harassment and stalking can get used for. And quite often it's the form of, you know, again, texts or emails to an ex-partner, but normally in the hundreds, you know, and then quite often can be aggressive or threatening or violent in their nature, you know. So that's what it's normally used for. But it fitted the bill in relation to this, you know, this hundreds and thousands of emails and documents that were sent to this particular MP. So that was the inquiry I was dealing with. And I'd done a certain amount of work on it myself, but I needed to actually go out and visit the person in question. Now, if you think back a good few episodes now, when I first arrived in Police Scotland, I said one of the big differences between the England and Wales policing and the Scottish policing, where the laws differ slightly, is that quite often you'll see single crewed cars in England and Wales, you know, so cops by themselves. And if they see something happen, they're able to act on it, they're able to give their own evidence, and that can go forward and potentially, you know, there can be a charge from what the single crewed cop says they saw. But in Scotland, that's much more difficult in that scenario, and that's why you'll never, well, I say never, never say never, of course, but have single crewed cops in Scotland, because they need this corroboration. So you might see a cop, you know, driving to take a statement by themselves, but they'll never be actively sort of patrolling as a single cop in Scotland, because you know, you need this corroboration. There needs to be two separate people giving evidence in relation to what's seen. So you must always have, if you remember, they called neighbours in Scotland. So I must always have a neighbour with me, and then we both give evidence that we saw, you know, Joe Bloggs go and smash that window, and us two giving evidence is sufficient. Now, of course, that second piece of evidence come from somewhere else, as we've discussed before again. So, for example, you know, I see it, I give it in my evidence, and then also I find CCT evidence that, you know, shows the offence being committed as well. So there is your two forms of evidence. That's the corroboration that you need, and that's how you can go forward. But generally, you know, cops will always be together. So coming back to my inquiry, I had to go out to this person's home address and basically get some details off them, and make it clear that the sort of route that this was taking, and that they were going to find themselves you know, in the sort of criminal world, and looking at charges if they didn't sort of stop, basically. But I virtually always worked by myself in the role I had of that counter-terrorist role, because it was just me in that area. So I didn't really have a set neighbour. If I had an inquiry, I would generally try and find a uniformed cop, one of my friends on the teams, and say, can you just, you know, jump in with me? And that's exactly what happened on this day. I went down to the sort of report writing room, found one of the uniformed cops who I knew pretty well, and said, look, I've got a quick inquiry to make. Now, two things you never say as a police officer. Firstly, the Q word, and it pains me even to say it now, quiet. We never, ever say the quiet word. They just say the Q word in generally the emergency services, but particularly the police, because normally the second you say that word, you know, the whole world explodes and terrible things happen. So it's, you know, cops take a really dim view of people saying that. So you only ever use the Q word, and you generally wouldn't sit there and go, oh, it's Q tonight, isn't it? Because, you know, bad things are going to happen. And the other thing is, you generally, you know, you're in trouble if you say to someone, it's just a quick inquiry, it won't take long. And unfortunately, stupidly, that is exactly what I said, you know, to my colleague, because he said, oh, I'm off duty in like an hour, you know, and I've got something on tonight. I said, well, that's no problems, you know, it's just a quick inquiry, it'll take like half an hour tops, and then we'll be back, and that'll be it. I just need a neighbour with me, just in case this person says something incriminating, I need that corroboration. So I just need a neighbour with me. Yeah, no problems at all. So they jumped in the car that I was driving, jumped into a marked car, although I was in plain clothes. No, I was in uniform that day. Sorry, no, we're both in uniform. And we went out to this address. So we carried out the inquiry, and that was pretty straightforward. And it did, sure enough, took, you know, literally like 10, 15 minutes. Needed to obtain some details from them. And we were just heading back to the Nick when a call came in over the radio that there'd been a head-on car crash, very bad injuries, you know, at least two vehicles involved, general sort of, you know, chaos on the roads. Now, we were not that far from that particular job. Now, one thing you don't get the luxury of in the police is ever sort of saying, I'm, you know, that's not my role. I'm counter-terrorism. I don't deal with car accidents. I'm, you know, burglary squad. I don't deal with, you know, someone being attacked. You know, that's not the option. Yes, of course, you're a specialist in your area and you generally on a day-to-day basis, you know, stick with your sort of specialism if you have one. Of course, response cops, as we've discussed many times, cover everything, you know, literally everything. But yeah, so you don't get the opportunity of sitting back and going, oh, no, that'll be one for the, you know, for traffic, because, you know, I'm a whatever cop and I don't deal with that. And bearing in mind just how serious it was. Now, if it had been, you know, a fender bender where somebody has tapped into the back end, there's no injuries, they're exchanging details, all very straightforward, you know, maybe we wouldn't have gone if they said there's a car going, it's going to be 10 minutes and we're like, you know, 2 or 3 minutes closer. Perhaps we wouldn't have gone in that scenario. But obviously, given the gravity and the seriousness of this accident, and also I knew for a fact that it was quite rural and we were, you know, maybe 5-10 minutes away and the nearest car was probably 10-15 minutes away at least, so we were considerably closer. So I said to my colleague, you know, and he had no problems with it, you know, we can't leave this, we've got to go regardless, you know, unfortunately, of you wanting to get off duty and go home, you know, that is the life of a cop. You know, you do not get that luxury of just saying, sorry, I've finished work now, you know, I'm out the door. You know, you can't do it. And he wouldn't have dreamt of it anyway. So we went flying off on blues to this accident, not really knowing what we were going to find. Now, this cop I was working with, very sound guy, not loads of service. I think he had maybe 2 years in or something, but definitely was developing into a really decent, solid cop, you know. But I don't think he'd been to that many serious accidents before, and certainly not fatal accidents or anything like that. He'd never done CPR before, you know, because a lot of cops haven't, you know, quite often you generally would have a fair bit of service before that happens. Now, the one thing that used to happen a lot, unfortunately, in the area I worked in, it was a lot of very fast roads, you know, national speed limit, which is 60 mile an hour in the UK, about 100 kilometres for, you know, our EU friends, about 100 kilometres an hour is sort of 60. That's the national speed limit, of course. That's what, you know, the limit is. Most people see that as a guide, you know, and perhaps are doing 70 or 80 down these roads. Now, some of these roads, you know, dead straight and what have you, maybe it's safe. You know, that's a debate for somebody else, not me. Obviously, you're still breaking the law, but, you know, maybe safe on those roads, certainly. Unfortunately, these roads really attracted a lot of motorcyclists because there was very twisty rural roads in, you know, sort of mountainous regions. Really pretty area for sure. But the issue with that is, you know, you come round blind bends at 80 mile an hour to find that, you know, there's a car broken down around the corner or there's a tree down across the road. You know, that happens very regularly in this area. And that's something you can't account for. Now, they always said, you know, on certainly the advanced driving course that I did in the police, you know, you only ever drive as fast as the distance you can see. So if you've got a blind bend, no matter what happens, no matter how highly qualified you are not going round it at stupid speeds. Because if you find those things round the corner, you need an option to stop. You need to be able to stop in the distance you can see ahead of you. And if that, you know, that distance ahead of you is severely obstructed by this sharp bend, for example, you know, you cannot, you'd be crazy to go around those speeds. Unfortunately, you know, most of the members of the public on the road have no training in driving apart from their, you know, initial sort of driving tests and lessons, or just don't care, you know, quite frankly. They, you know, it's a racetrack and they're going to drive as fast as they can and as fast as they want. So we used to see a lot of big accidents and a lot of big fatals, quite often with motorbikes, but not exclusively. And sure enough, this one was two cars head on into each other. So we went blatting up to the scene. I think we were the first car there by about 10 seconds, or maybe the second car, but, you know, by 10 seconds, the car either ahead or behind us, they hadn't even had a chance to sort of get out of the vehicle. So we got out together. And what I saw was one car, a red Honda Civic, was sort of sideways across the road and then facing, sort of semi-facing the wrong way on the road. And then there was a dark, I think it was a VW Passat, was facing the right way on the road, but was on the grass verge, partially on the grass verge, and it almost looked like it had been sort of reverse parked there. Now, this particular bit of road is national speed limit, so 60 mile an hour, but it was dead straight. You know, I've just told you how sort of curvy and bendy these roads are, and, you know, and there's barely a straight road in the area. But this one particular bit, strangely, is about a mile-long straight where you can see from one end to the other with very few junctions, only a couple of private houses that kind of emerge onto this road. So generally, unfortunately, if people were going to speed, you know, this would be quite an obvious road for it, because they think it's clear, they put their foot down or twist the throttle on the motorbike and off they go, you know. So it can be a very fast bit of road. But we didn't have many accidents on it because, you know, unless you were drunk or something and drifted off the road, then pretty unlikely you're going to kind of come a cropper, because there was no bends to negotiate. So initially it wasn't clear what had happened, but then that was the least of our worries, because we jumped out and the first car we got to was this Honda Civic, and that contained two elderly ladies. I think they were in about their 80s, something like that, both in the front seats, obviously the driver and the front seat passenger. The driver, unfortunately, there was heavy frontal damage on the car, and the steering wheel had been pushed right up and back into her chest. And also I could see that her legs were trapped by the car itself, which had pushed back into her as well. I went round and I tried to find a pulse on her and I couldn't. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a pulse, because I can tell you that even trained doctors in a stressful situation out on the streets struggle to find pulses. They've very much gone away from it in the first aid world, because it's really easy to miss them. So you're more trying to assess on breathing, colour, you know, things like that. I have to say, from her colour and the way she was, I was pretty confident she was dead straight away. You know, obviously not a doctor or a paramedic or anything like that, have seen quite a bit of death, as you've obviously heard throughout these episodes if you've been listening to the series. And yes, I was 95% sure that she was dead. So unfortunately, in this scenario, you have to triage. You have to be, you're not being God, you're not playing God for sure, but you do have to make decisions when you've only got limited resources, who you're going to deal with first. And this comes back a little bit, unfortunately, again to Westminster Bridge, the terrorist attack that I was at. And again, obviously go back a good few episodes if you want to hear that one. You have to make hard decisions as to who you're going to deal with. Now, this female, unfortunately, the driver, I was pretty sure was beyond help, certainly the sort of help that I could give. You know, maybe if I'd been, you know, an amazing surgeon or something with my full surgical team on standby, perhaps you could have done something. But you know, little old me with, you know, a single plaster in my first aid kit, I was pretty confident there wasn't much I could do. So I went round to the female passenger and I shouted to my colleague that, you know, I don't think there's anything we can do for this one. We went round to, and that definitely shocked him a bit as well. You know, he stopped in his tracks just for a second and kind of looked at me, and it just took that second or two to sink in, bearing in mind he'd never been at anything like this before, I don't think. And certainly the other two cops that turned up as well, very young in service, probably less than a year between them. In fact, one of them, I think it was the very first accident he'd been to at all, never mind a serious one, a fatal or whatever. So it was a hell of an accident to start with. Anyway, I rushed around to the front seat passenger, another elderly female, and she was in a real bad way. She wasn't really conscious, but she was breathing. I could tell she was breathing, which is different to the driver. Now, just coming back to the driver briefly, we weren't in a position to drag her out and start CPR on her. You know, we couldn't get her out because of how the damage was and had pinned her legs into the car. And the steering wheel was so close to her chest. Obviously, the airbags are deployed sideways, you know, side, front, above. There's airbags all over the place in modern cars. So very difficult to even get to her. So not only could we not get her out of the car, but we almost certainly couldn't do any sort of CPR on her. And unfortunately, it was a similar position to the front seat passenger. She had the damaged front end of the car was pushed back up and trapping her legs in the vehicle. We tried to lift her legs out of the way and pull her legs out to start with, but it just wasn't happening. But she was breathing initially. And then very quickly, while we were trying to get her legs out, she stopped breathing. And we wound her seat down flat, as flat as we could get, knowing that we couldn't remove her from the car. But I said to my colleague, I think we can, you know, get in and maybe try and do some CPR. It's not going to be very effective, but it's either that or you stand here and watch her die. You know, you can't do that. You have to do something. So sure enough, that's what we did. We wound the seat right back. My colleague jumped in on top of her, sort of sat astride her as best he could, bearing in mind you've also got this other poor female next to him you know, that we're pretty confident has already died. And he did the best he could doing CPR. Now, it's rubbish CPR. We knew that because, for a start, you're doing it on a soft seat. So with each chest compression, you're compressing the, you know, the foam seat. So you're not getting good compressions into her chest to get her heart pumping. You're getting something in. The thinking is that initially, you're not too worried about, if it's just happened, about getting breaths into them, because there's a certain amount of oxygenated blood traveling around your system anyway. You know, if this has happened, like we think, you know, 2-3 minutes before, there's a lot of oxygenated blood in her system, and we want to start circulating that. And then maybe if we're in a position, we can start trying to get breaths into her as well from a CPR point of view. So he jumped on her and started doing the CPR. Now, I knew he'd need to swap, having done it at this point 3 or 4 times myself. It's really, really tiring. And that's if you're in the perfect position with them laying on, you know, a hard floor and sort of over top of them doing perfect chest compressions. You kind of got like 5, maybe 10 minutes before you are absolutely knackered and you need to swap out with someone. And really, you should be swapping every kind of 5 minutes tops to keep you both fresh if there's two of you there. One doing the breaths ideally, one doing the chest compressions. And the ratios change. You know, there've been various things throughout my career. They always, you know, seem to change. I think at the moment we're on 30 and two, so 30 chest compressions to 2 breaths. And first of all, you've got to, of course, make sure that you extend the neck and tilt the head back slightly before you move the jaw down. You check for obstructions. You pinch the nose and then you start putting in your breaths while your head is turned to the side, looking at their chest to see that it raises and falls and that you're getting effective breaths into them. Sorry, that was like a 30-second CPR course there. So he started that. At this point, the ambulance turned up. Now, the ambulance guy, I have to say, really hacked me off. He came running up on a mission. Of course, that's exactly what you'd want him to do. And then he basically started shouting at me and my colleague that, what were we doing, making out like we were idiots, trying to do CPR on her in the car? You know, drag her out and do proper CPR. You can't do CPR on a car. And he started going off into one. And I had to say, yeah, it really annoyed me at the time. And I had to pretty much shout at him and say, don't you think we've thought of that? She's trapped by her legs. We can't get her out. Is this sort of CPR or no CPR? And when he realised, he kind of changed his mind completely and you know, sort of calmed down a bit. It's one of the only times I've ever had an issue, actually, with a paramedic. But yeah, it did annoy me intensely because I think he thought, you know, we're just complete idiots who had no, you know, clue of what we're doing, which I have to say throughout most of my career, that would probably cover it quite nicely. But, you know, I knew just a very basic amount about CPR. So once we explained that, he realised, he went round to the driver and very quickly formed the same opinion as us, that there was nothing to be done for her, which I was a little bit, not pleased, that's not the right word, but felt, you know, reassured that he also felt the same. Had he at that point gone, oh my God, she's breathing, why didn't you do anything for her? You know, I'd have felt bad that we had moved on. But no, sure enough, he said, there's nothing can be done for her. So we went over now to the, my colleague carried on the CPR, and in fact, the paramedics then took over, and we were waiting for the fire brigade to come because really we needed them to cut her out as best they could so that we could then start doing, you know, first aid effectively. And we went over to the second car, the VW Passat, which was, as I say, looked like it was parked on the grass verge. Now, there was a kind of youngish, middle-aged couple, kind of 50 years old maybe, male and female. I think the male was driving, female was front seat passenger. And they were both sat dead still in the car, clearly in shock, very, very pale, not really saying a lot, just sort of, he was still gripping the steering wheel, just kind of staring ahead, like 1,000-yard stare. And the wife was, again, very, very, you know, sort of still. So I think the window was smashed or it was open, but certainly I was able to speak to them. And I said, hi, you know, you're all right. Where are you hurt? You must be hurt, because they had a really heavy frontal damage on their car. And I could also hear some whimpering in the back. They had 2 red setter dogs in the boot of their car. And so I spoke to him and he said that his chest was really hurting. And I said, you know, have you ever had like heart attack hurting? You know, have you ever had, you know, sort of chest pains and heart attack or anything like that? You know, you're on medication. And he was saying, no, this feels different. You know, he said he couldn't really describe it, but he was struggling to breathe a bit. And there was something going on with the front of his chest, or maybe I was thinking ribs or something. And then when I went round to her, she said that her back felt funny, you know, tingly, and so did her legs. So obviously you're thinking all sorts of things here. You've got to be really, really careful. Thankfully, the fire brigade turned up now fairly quickly. And they basically took the roof off their car, which is the standard thing fire brigade do. Use their jaws of life, kind of snip the four pillars of the vehicle, and then you're able to remove the roof. And now you can take people out a lot easier and a lot safer out of the way. Plus, we had kind of 10 fire crew now, so you've got the resources and the hands basically to get these people out. And that's what we did. We very carefully removed him. And he was able to sort of help us and semi get out. This is once they've got neck collars on to make sure they're okay. And so he came out and was taken carefully off into the ambulance. Now, all he was worried about, apart from his wife, obviously, was the two dogs in the back. You know, they're obviously absolute dog lovers. And I said, you know, don't worry. I've got dogs as well. I'm a dog lover. We'll sort that. The dogs, you know, we'll look after them. I said, but they seem okay, because although I'd heard them whimpering, I'd also seen that they were both at least alive. So he was reassured by that a bit, and he was packed off into the ambulance. And then the wife, we went round. Now, she was a lot more difficult to get out because she was put in a neck brace, but there were some real concerns about back injury for her, with her talking about, you know, her tingly sort of leg and back, you know, and this strange feeling that she had. So she came out of there really carefully. We couldn't really get a backboard onto her, but we managed to get her very gently lifted out and standing upright. And then what we did was we put a backboard up to her, with her sort of semi-standing supported upright, put the backboard next to her, and then we're able to tighten the straps around her with her still standing and the backboard behind her. And then she was very gently lowered into the sort of prone position so that we could carry her. Now, unfortunately, at the edge of this road running all the way along, it was a ditch all the way along for drainage. So as we gently lowered her, and I say gently, cautiously, me and my colleague, because now there were several other cops there now, you know, we had quite a few cars there, traffic and all sorts of cars had turned up, both me and the other officer pretty much fell over backwards into this ditch, which we hadn't realized was there. And she started to fall backwards. Now, she is helpless at this point because she's strapped in to the backboard, so she's entirely relying on us to look after her. But thankfully, although we both fell back, we only lost control of her briefly, and as she started to sort of tip back, we were able to put our hands up above our heads, because now we're in the ditch. And you know, she only sort of moved back a matter of inches before we sort of got hold of the backboard again. So, you know, I'm pretty confident we didn't do any further damage. Anyway, she was into the ambulance and away, as was the husband. So we got into the boot. Initially, we couldn't open the boot of the car. It had also been damaged in the accident, so we had to sort of smash side windows and go in through folded rear seats to get into the boot. Thankfully, the dogs were shocked and friendly, because had they been, you know, sort of killer dogs, me sticking my head in the back probably wouldn't have gone down too well. But eventually we got them both out, and I'd spoken to the local vet, who I knew quite well, and she came out and took both the dogs. We managed to get leads on them and lead them away. And I was a bit concerned for the dogs, for sure, because very much as a dog lover myself, and both, as they walked away, although they weren't sort of crying or whimpering, their back legs looked a bit strange. They were almost walking with like an S shape, you know, they weren't walking properly. So I was pretty confident they had sort of back or leg injuries themselves. And then really it was a cleanup process, you know, and it took a long time sorting out the debris on the road, recovering the vehicles, unfortunately removing the body of the lady, which took a while because she was so trapped in her car by her legs, very difficult to remove her. But eventually the fire brigade sort of cut sufficient metal to get her out. So having gone out to this, you know, pretty straightforward 10-minute inquiry, a quick job, as I stupidly said to my colleague, you know, it turned into a, unfortunately, what ended up as being a double fatal car accident head on, because both the females, elderly females in the Civic died of the VW Passat. They had the male driver had a broken sternum, so the front of his chest effectively had caved in and caused quite a few injuries, but he was able to recover okay. And his wife, the one on the backboard, she did actually have a broken spine in several places. I think she had some quite nasty damage there, but luckily there was no issues with her spinal cord, so it didn't affect her walking. And similar injuries actually on both the dogs, the red setters, they both had I think one had a broken leg and one had a broken back, but amazingly, having spoken to the vet several times about it afterwards, they also made full recoveries having had surgery. So a terrible accident, really, you know, and it just shows that, you know, no matter what your plans are in the police, they can change in the blink of an eye. And they still don't actually know really what happened. They think, and this is guesswork, that maybe the female, elderly female driver of the Civic on that great big long straight wasn't going that fast, like 50 mile an hour or something, and either had a medical episode herself, which they could have never established for sure, or fell asleep at the wheel, one of the two maybe, because the witnesses said that she'd basically just drifted across in her lane into the oncoming traffic, which was the VW Passat coming the other way, hence them having this head-on smash. And they were both doing about 50, so you've got an impact speed of 100 mile an hour because you add the two together to get your impact speed. So it's a hell of an impact. I mean, they were lucky, really, that anyone walked away from it. But a very strange place to have an accident, you know, of all the places and all these twisty, mountainous, hilly roads, you know, the straightest, flattest bit of road that we've got in the area, and that's where it happened. But there we go. So that's that for this week. One more next week, I think, and then we'll talk about what we're going to do then, if anything. Perhaps get your thinking caps on. Perhaps think where you would like the podcast to go, if anywhere. If you want me to just be quiet and go away, not a problem, I'll do that. But there are a few options knocking around in my head, and some other news in relation to a possible book and things. But we'll talk about that next week. For now, that's it. Have a good week. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.